regress because it, or a slippery slope, because it really is reducible down to morality is whatever an individual person says it is. And that's an extreme moral relativism, which I would say is a tautology, because there's no point in even using the word morality if it just reduces down to what individuals want to do or not. So that's an extreme on the other side. That's one of the criticisms leveled against moral relativism. It's reducible down to nothing. But there's something in between, which is you could make an argument that there could be conflicting views of what's moral in different parts of the world, among different subcultures. And that's okay, and morality still means something because it's the intent behind what people hold as moral that makes it moral. It's not the end result itself. It's the intent behind it. So you could say that people who are vegans or vegetarians and they say they're morally opposed to eating meat, that if the reason they're doing that is a sincerely held belief that they don't want to harm and they don't have a right to harm other living things, or if it's a sincerely held belief that they want to leave a better world for our children and their children and for future generations by reducing carbon emissions, if these are sincerely held beliefs, and that's what makes that morality a legitimate, bona fide morality. So, because it's moral to care about others, right? There is a universal morality in caring about others. There is a universal morality.
Virtues, yeah.
Right. On the other hand, if somebody says, I don't think there's anything wrong with overcharging my customers or for corporations to rip off.
Yeah, that's like somebody's like, that's where like I really struggle with that, because it's like, oh, I wish I had $1 million and that's my intent, so I'm going to charge everyone 50% more right. than what I should because I wish that right. I had more money.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But see, that's not moral. Moral relativism doesn't apply to that. It's not moral because it's self-serving. It's not caring about others. It doesn't respect the overall moral values.
But what if that person with that wants that $1 million says that they're going to build a charity with it?
Well, if they really do that, that's a different thing.
But what if it's not obtainable and they just end up ripping everybody off 50%? And that's my kind of argument. It's an unobtainable goal.
Well, were they sincere in when they stated they were going to...
Whether they're sincere or not, the fact is they still took 50% more from the people. So without relating it to something tangible, our wish can be anything.
I think it's in, like your actual intent, you know, the actual intent and the result, and then are you willing to adjust your actions based on the actual result.
Yeah. And I think if you have tangible intent, then maybe like small goals, but then who regulates that? Right? So with meat consumption, right? So we say, okay, well, we wish that we had unlimited resources. We wish everybody could eat meat. We wish that that was ethical and you know, we put aside the human or animal suffering and the vegan side of things. And we think that everybody, because they're human and omnivores and have the capacity to eat meat, that they should and ought to eat meat. So then we have enough resources. So our wish is that we have this capacity for everybody in Canada. But the goal and the intent is there, and then we tax to be able to pay for the transition of resources from one person to another, and we still find out that there still is many people going malnutritioned, and they don't equally get access to meat. This is kind of the debate which happens between the haves and the have-nots, depending on where you're located, how you how you were able, like if you're living in the Northwest Territories versus living in Vancouver, your access to be able to get that meat is going to be very different.
Okay, so what's your argument? What's your argument and what's your conclusion? Now we're going to get back to a little more basic philosophy. So I'm getting a little confused where you're leading this. So what's your conclusion first. What's your conclusion?
That eating meat and having a two-tiered diet is morally permissible with a cultural relativist point of view.
Okay, so your argument that it's morally permissible to have a society where some people can afford meat and others can't.
Yeah, because we live, unfortunately, in a capitalist society, and that's what we've all agreed upon is acceptable.
Okay, so your conclusion is that it's acceptable to have a society, a two-tiered system where some people can't afford meat and others can, and by implication, it's acceptable to have a society where people eat meat, where meat's raised and slaughtered and eaten. All that's acceptable. And one of your reasons is because you think it would be impractical to do otherwise.
Yeah, it's an unobtainable promise.
Right. To do anything different is unobtainable. So you're saying that's the only option, because to do anything different would be a failure. To make any attempt to subsidize the cost of meat for people that can't afford it, that would fail.
It still wouldn't be equal. Yeah, like the true equalness of it wouldn't exist. So then those efforts are kind of...
Okay, so you're saying it wouldn't be... any effort would be futile, would like to do that. And then you're also making the argument in support of your conclusion that it's morally just to have it that way, two-tiered meat, regardless of the environmental consequences, because we live in a capitalist society and we've decided as a society to allow all that, so therefore that makes it right. Okay, well, I disagree with you, but we can't go around circles. I don't agree with you, but I have to respect your view for the purposes of the show.
So and so I guess like the other really other side to this coin would be whether or not even the way that we treat the animals. So like say like we can all eat meat if we continue with factory farming and we continue to contribute to climate change, and that's the way that we all equally can obtain this diet. Then we have this problem about how we treat animals and whether or not how we treat them. You know, some animals we think it's okay to eat in Canada, and some of them are our best friend. They're our dogs and our cats and our birds. And so that is another really interesting question that I find to be also more of a moral relativist point of view, because we seem to select some animals as untouchable and other ones as okay.
So if you were being consistent, it seems like you would need to argue that that since that's the way we do it in our country, that therefore it's morally permissible, right? That's what your argument is, right? That what a country decides to do, what the laws are, what the government says, what the people agree on. I'm not sure those are always the same, but something like that. There's whatever the result is of the debate in a country like Canada. There's differences of opinion, but we arrive at policies and we make some decisions, even though not everyone agrees. Those decisions that are made and those decisions manifest in laws and public policy and that kind of thing. You're saying that those are morally legitimate. Because of the very fact that that's what the country has decided
and that's what I see with my eyes and my senses, and you know, unfortunately we haven't made our cows and our moose part of society. They're not sovereign.
So what's are you saying that it's wrong that we eat cows but not dogs, or is that perfectly fine because that's what we've decided in our society?
I think, like, in a moral relativist point of view, it is. But in my own perspective, I think it is also a little illogical, because we're saying sometimes we can with this animal, but then with a we can go out hunting and we can kill the wolf, but then we go home and we see the wolf. It's the same animal.
So tell me again, what's your conclusion that you're arguing for?
I'm just flipping it a little bit in the way of talking about morality as a universal. If we were to say we ought to, and so, because, like, the problem with a relativist is then if you go to the definition, right, and the definition of an animal. And I was like, well, we're all animals.
Oh, are you taking the opposite position?
Yeah.
You're opposed to moral relativism?
Well, I'm definitely sparking some of the complicatedness of my conclusion, because I come down to it and then I'm like, but wait a minute. We're all animals. So is this just, you know, do we need to think about what our consciousness is and how we perceive things?
Well, like I was saying before, the strict traditionalist view, the Kantian view of morality would be that we need to discover what morality is. It's there. We don't create it. We discover it.
If we discover it, but that's where it says, like, where is this universal morality? Because for me, all I can really find is maybe, you know, we ought not do any undue harm to anything, you know.
It's much more than that.
You know, I've also kind of come maybe like a universality of love and beauty. Like, we seem like in a platonic point of way, we all seem to find that those things bring us pleasure and goodness and that seems to be a universal around the world. Like, we all can appreciate a flower.
Well, you know what's interesting is in our pursuit of morality, and this is not inconsistent with there being a fixed, universalizable, universal, non-relativistic morality. This is not what I'm going to say now is not inconsistent with that. As human beings, as a culture, as a human race, we're trying to discover what that universal morality is, and we may not know yet what it is, but we're gradually learning more and more about morality. I'm taking this position now that there is a universal morality. It's to be discovered, not to be manufactured, right? So let me give you an example. So back not that long ago, the moral circle of concern did not include women. Women, you know, there wasn't any kind of moral obligation to women. Not that long ago, there wasn't moral obligation or at least not an equal moral obligation to people of color, right? So there were black slaves in the United States and other places. So they weren't worthy of the same moral treatment or respect as white people.
Yeah, you're talking about like the libertization movement, liberty movement.
Yeah, the gradual expansion of the circle of moral concern, I'm going to call it, and that comes from from environmental ethics. So it doesn't mean that at one time it was moral to have black slaves. It doesn't mean that it was moral to treat women as second-class citizens, it doesn't mean that it's moral to have a glass ceiling that women can't rise above in the workplace. It doesn't mean that it's moral to think of women as like sex objects. So it just means that we hadn't yet discovered what morality is, but we're discovering it, and now we've discovered that we were treating people of color in an immoral way. Now we realize what we were doing, and so now we've corrected that, or we're trying to correct that. So in environmental ethics, the one of the topics is, well, does nature have status as a moral entity? And to the extent that humans have ignored or not respected or have harmed nature itself by chopping down forests or by spewing carbons and ozones and so on into the atmosphere, now maybe we need to realize that that's immoral, because we are harming an entity, which is nature, which has an intrinsic moral status. And maybe that's the case with animals. So maybe it's taken humanity a long time to realize that cows and and sheep and everything we eat, we kill and eat, right? Chickens, that these are living things which have moral rights, and we are morally obligated to respect those life forms. And just because they're not humans doesn't mean that we can harm them any more than we could harm women or we could harm people of color. And so we are learning more and more what this universal morality is. We're not making it up as we go along. We're discovering what it is.
But if we're going to look at it in an environmentalist point of view, we also have to consider how the animal kingdom works within the food chain, and how we do have, I believe it's an open system, where, you know, you have your smallest animals, and then the larger animals eat smaller animals, and so forth. And once they die, they, you know, go back into the soil, and then they create new life, and that life is then ate, and then we have this circle of life, you know. Kumbaya.
Well, you're alluding to an argument which is made that humans are animals. Yeah, we're a different type of animal, maybe a more sophisticated animal, but we're animals like any other animal. And if you look at the animal kingdom, you see animals killing and eating other animals, many of them, not all of them, the ones that are, you know, carnivores, right?
Yeah. There's the pyramid, I guess you could
right,
call it.
Right. And so why should humans be any different? Like, how can you say it's wrong for humans to do what we observe every other species or many other species? Even species that don't eat animals, they're eating plants, and there are people that say it's wrong to eat plants, right?
Well, that's where it's just like, how can we say that we are equal but then also have the capacity to be so different?
So, right, so that's the response. So it's also true that humans have the capacity for rationality, and we have the capacity to even have this debate about whether it's moral or not to kill other animals and eat them. So we could say that probably we're the only species that even has the capacity and the awareness to even think about that. So when we go out and, you know, into the wilderness and look at the pyramid of life or whatever, and we see animals killing other animals, it's probably reasonable to say that they don't think about it. They just do it instinctively. They're not sitting there debating, should we or should we not? Is it moral or is it not moral for me as a, you know, lion to go kill that, you know, giraffe or whatever? They don't think about it. But humans, as part of the natural course, as part of evolution, have the capacity, as evidenced by this discussion we're having now, to be aware of what we're doing for food, who we're killing, what we're killing. And so it's completely natural for us to become aware that we don't need to and we shouldn't be killing other animals, because that's causing suffering and causing harm.
But then when I'm stepping around and I'm killing the tiny little bugs, should I be concerned about that as well?
There are some religious groups that are concerned about accidentally breathing in insects or something. It's a question of degree, perhaps.
But then a degree isn't a universal moral. So yeah. We're back to my relativist point of view.
Yeah, this is Kira, this is the problem with philosophy. This is either the blessing or the problem with philosophy. We can't get to the answer here. We just go around circles. We're going around circles, right? Because if you we can find some pretty big flaws in moral relativism. For example, the flaw that it's reducible to nothing.
Yeah.
But we can find some pretty big flaws with absolutism, because how can you be absolute? Because if you're absolute, you can't breathe, because you're breathing in, you're killing, you know, organisms that are in the air by breathing them in. The only way to respect all life is to simply die. The problem we're running into is that it doesn't seem like there's consistency in any position around morality.
Yeah, because we still serve our interests. Our own self-interest.
Maybe the answer is what I was saying before. It's to take a flexible position, which is in between the absolutes of moral absolutism on one extreme and moral relativism on the other extreme, and maybe to take the position that we can't be absolute, because you can't live without killing things.
And this is why I love the liberals, because we're in between. You know, and where Canada is great as a democracy is we sit in parliament with seats for everybody.
Oh, so now we're getting into politics. But that's fine, because
we'll just circle back a little.
No, we were just saying before the show that we actually we might as well tell our listeners that at least on some of these shows, we're going to be a little bit more willing to...
We're going to debate and talk about politics and you're all going to hate me because I am very open about my points of view.
Well, good. I'd like to figure out what your points of view are, Kira, because you really, I don't know if you were playing devil's advocate or what, but you sounded for quite a bit of the show like a pretty staunch conservative.
So that's where I'm not. So that's the thing. Like I grew up definitely on a farm. So I grew up watching life and death, and that's the way of life. And, you know, and then I moved down south, moved to good old Vancouver, BC. And I learned about the libertarian movement, and I learned about how we are not equal in our states of life, but we should and ought to try and make it feel like life is worth living for everyone in Canada. I think that's part of the reason we're proud to be Canadians, is the fact that we have free healthcare and we care about our neighbor, and we have this very religious Catholic point of view, or Christian point of view, I guess, within our laws. And I find that is challenged a lot down south with our indigenous perspectives, with our environmental perspectives. And so for me, my politics and have been playing ping pong a little bit.
Universal health care is an example of those in society with more money subsidizing those with less money. I'm looking for some consistency in your positions. So are you in favor or against universal health care?
I am in favor of universal health care.
I'm arguing that universal health care is an example of redistribution of wealth from the rich people to the poor people.
Correct. But I still believe that the rich people should have access, and they do have access to two-tiered medicine.
You're in favor of two-tiered.
You know, because that's where, you know, yes, we have universal health care. Where's the morals in that, right? So it's like what we ought to do versus what is realistic and what actually happens seems to be a relativist point of view. So we can live in this idealistic society, but then when we actually look at the facts, it's not so idealistic.
You're in favor of two-tier health?
I am, unfortunately, because we live in a capitalist point of view that it's, I want to protect and do what we can, but then I also don't think that the person who can afford the MRI, instead of waiting 6 months, should suffer.
You're talking about practicality, right? That's been your position. One of your positions throughout the show today is like what it really matters, what's attainable, right? And what's attainable, you're saying, plays a big role in whether something should or shouldn't be.
Well, yeah, just to ground ourselves in what ought to be. Like, I want to be as universal moral as I can, but then I still need to ground myself in what is practical.
Okay. So there, one of the arguments against two-tier health care is that it's not... that it's internally contradictory, that it's not actually attainable, because if you truly have a two-tier health care, it will erode and degrade and compromise and destroy the public universal health care. There's an argument around that, but you know, whether that's the case or not. But I'm just saying that that is one of the arguments against two-tier healthcare, is that it takes resources away from the public system, and it's not actually attainable in the long run to ever achieve this mm-hmm. ideal of having two-tier.
I just find then you're comparing some rights to be more worthy than other rights. So therefore, like, okay, yes, we ought to have, universal health care and not two-tiered, because then it is equally fair. But while we do that, then we infringe on people's liberty to be able to leave the country and have their own free will of what they would like to do with their bodies.
You were the one that said you were advocating for two-tier, and I'm just saying, we don't have time to get into it now, but I'm saying that one of the arguments against two-tier, maybe it's not correct, but one of the arguments against two-tier is that it's actually not attainable, because you can't have a private and a public in parallel, because the private will, the private will eat away at, degrade public, because it will sap resources away from the public, because there's more money, right? There'll be more people, the doctors and nurses and so on would rather work in the private, because they can make more money, because people are willing to pay more, and that'll leave people in the public system without quality care.
And that is the end of our show. Thank you for listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show with Kira Tianen and Michael Kadid.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM. Talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors, and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
Looking for a community who will support you on your academic journey? The Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all three SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.